From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our callers, some interesting topics to talk about?
Yes, olive oil. We know it's good for us. We know the Mediterranean diet is loaded with olive oil. We know that people are healthier with it. Is it the scent and smell of the olive oil? Some interesting research on aromas and weight.
Okay, and?
And then your child's pacifier. Now, I am the father of four children. That's a long time ago, more than 30 years for some of my kids when they were children. And yes, they did occasionally have pacifiers. And yes, we did clean them up sometimes when we were somewhere else and they fell on the ground. Mm-hmm. And the question is, if you suck on your child's pacifier, are you spreading germs? The truth. If you listen in, I will tell you what the truth
okay,
is.
Okay, coming up, and we have a good recipe.
Yes, salmon with peppers and charmoula.
Mm-hmm. A guest chef will be with us on the phone. Again, that number is 800-462-7413. And let's welcome our first caller now, Zorba, a listener with us in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I have a question about the relevance of biological age. I just had a birthday, and now I'm 66 years old. That really sounds old.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very active and very healthy, but I found on the internet a way to calculate biological age, and that ended up being 55. I'm really curious to know how relevant that is or how important is biological age.
Yeah, how did you get that figure?
Well, I went on the internet and filled out a bunch of questions related to diet and exercise and commitments calculated the biological age to be 55.
Uh-huh. Well, this is very, very, very interesting. Came out with a book called Real Age years ago, which was, I thought, an excellent book.
Mm-hmm.
That talked about the fact that, you know, your real age is going to be, if you're doing good health habits, less than your biological age. Now, at one level, that is complete hokum. I mean, your biological age, you are 66, and the reality is you are 66. Your genes are 66 years old. Your eyes are 66 years old. Your heart is 60. Your colon is 66 years old. But on the other hand, there's some people who are really kind of older. They're closer to death. That's really what it
is. We talk all the time, Zorba, about if you don't smoke, you live longer.
Absolutely.
If you have a good diet,
yeah,
you live longer.
Yeah, and all those things. So I think in many ways this is very relevant because, first of all, you look back and you say, hey, I'm doing everything right. I'm really not 66. I'm 55 because I really act like a 55-year-old. And the answer is yes. I think it's a very interesting concept that we physicians have never latched upon because we said, wait a minute, there's really no difference. The biological age is the same. But the fact is this gives people really a hands-on way of saying that my health habits make me younger than my actual biological age, what I actually am. So I think kudos, go to it. It's a website. And it's really most of these websites, I don't know which one you use, most of them are really based on good science saying, hey, you don't smoke cigarettes, you've got a good attitude, you're exercising, you're really younger than the age of 66. Now, here's the caveat. What they're doing is they're saying when you're 55, okay, versus 66, mm-hmm, you're going to die at 75, got it? Versus 66, which would say you would die at 85. So in other words, the concept is your age is less, but you'll die at a different chronological age. It's sort of a, if you will, it's a sleight of hand. I have a question for you. How do you feel?
I feel very good.
You feel good? That's exactly it. How do you picture a 66-year-old to feel?
That's a good question.
Right.
I know a lot of people my age that seem to be really struggling and really in bad shape.
Right. And what happens is as we get older, there's really a difference. When you're 25 or 30, 35 or 40, people may engage in bad habits, but their biological age hasn't really caught up with them. When you're 66, you have a curriculum vitae, a past medical history. You've been smoking for 30 years. You're overweight. You don't exercise. It catches up with you. So you've got a bimodal distribution. The ones who are healthy, 66 years old, and the ones who are not healthy. Some of that is luck. Some of that is how you played your cards. So basically, you are 56. I agree.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And congratulations on losing those 10 years of life.
On the other
I mean, 10 years, well, it wouldn't be 10 years of life. Congratulations on being younger by 10 years.
Yeah. On the other hand, Zorba, we all know people who totally abuse themselves.
Right, right.
Terrible attitudes,
correct.
Don't get any
correct.
Exercise, right. And live until 90.
And the, yeah, or live to 105. Well, but it's a statistical game. The reality is you lose 10 years of life by smoking, but not everyone who smokes loses 10 years of life. And when I talk to people, they'll say, well, my grandfather, he lived to 95. He ate lard every day, lard sandwiches, and drank a quart of whiskey and smoked cigarettes, and he lived until, you know, until his late 90s and never lost a day of sleep and continued working. And I go, well, congratulations to him. He is the exception to the rule, and that's the way to think about
somehow,
it.
Somehow, if you eat lard sandwiches, you kind of deserve to live a long time because you're torturing yourself.
Hey, that's what they used to have, lard and onion sandwiches back in the Depression, back in the day.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Columbus, Ohio. Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Thank you for taking my call. Well, real quick, a brief history of my work. Maybe it has something to do with my problem. I was in construction 30 years, changed careers 2 years ago, and now I'm a professional driver. My problem is every once in a while I will get these really bad cramps in my from my thigh down running to my foot. And it just mainly was when I'm laying down, I'll stretch. Like I'll wake up to stretch my legs, and then this terrible cramping starts. And I don't know what's going on and what's causing it.
Uh-huh. So a professional driver, you spend hours, they take it in a car or in a truck. Tell me a little bit about what you do.
Yes, I drive over the road in a big rig, if you will, and I spend most of my time in there. And I think that might have something to do with it, but I wasn't certain. I've used my right foot. I have cruise control, but I don't. So I don't use my right foot on the gas a lot.
Right. But that's a big issue with drivers. And I've got some suggestions on things you can do. First of all, one of the things you want to do is periodically stretch, because this is usually a problem with muscle shortening versus muscle tightening. So if you go to our website, zorbapastor.org, we'll put on some stretching exercises. If you Google stretching exercises and you write Achilles tendon, you will get the right stretching exercises, because basically when you stretch the Achilles tendon, you'll be reducing the calf muscle cramping, which is the cramping that occurs when all of a sudden your foot cramps and kind of cramps up. So how often do you stop when you're over the road?
Well, I usually say maybe 2 to 3 times per trip.
Okay. So what you want to do when you stop, you know, you stop, you're going to the washroom, maybe you're getting something to drink. When you go back to your truck, what you want to do, or when you're in the gas station, when you're gassing up, what you're going to want to do the stretching exercises. And I don't think you have to do a lot, but I think 2 minutes of stretching exercises is going to make a huge difference. So that's one of the things I would recommend. The other thing is sometimes magnesium pills can make a difference. Now, a cheap, inexpensive magnesium pill is a Philips milk of magnesia pill. Now, you have to be careful, because if you have too many Philips milk of magnesia pills, you will have to go to the washroom more often while you're going. but milk of magnesia is a really easy way. Maalox is also magnesium, has magnesium in it. And sometimes one pill once a day or twice a day, even the liquid would be okay, but liquid is just kind of messy. But one pill once a day or twice a day can make a difference in cramping. So stretching exercises, magnesium, those would be the two things I'd recommend you doing.
So in other words, when you say stretching, because when I feel the onslaught of that cramp coming, I will immediately try to pull my toes back to my shin.
Right. No, that's what you've got to do. You do anything to stop the cramp. Anything
and
toes back to the shin, back and forth will do it. To prevent it from happening, you want to do the stretching just when you get out and you gas up. No, you're doing the right thing. We all do. We've all had cramps in our calf, and the first thing we do is we move the calf to overcome the cramp. That's what we do.
It's awful.
Yeah.
So you would basically say it's a work-related thing, not an internal issue going on there.
I don't think so. I think it's work-related. I think it's sitting in the rig. It's a work-related thing, and it's actually what happens to a lot of people when they don't use their leg very much. It happens when people go to sleep, and it happens with a lot of long-distance drivers like yourself.
I gotcha. Very good. Well, that helps me out so much, and I very much appreciate your help.
Great. Keep on trucking.
Thank you very much. I'll have a great day.
Yep. Thanks.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Before our next call, Zorba, the health benefit from olive oil may be in the scent?
Right. Well, that's kind of the million-dollar question that they were trying to answer by these studies. And there are two parts of the study that are very interesting. So let's go to part number one. Part number one was yogurt. They gave a number of people yogurt, and into the yogurt they added regular sort of extra fat, lard, butter, olive oil, canola oil, or nothing.
Okay.
So that was the first part. Just added that. 120 people randomly split into these groups. And they found the olive oil, people who had olive oil in their yogurt, had increased serotonin, which we know is associated with, it's a brain chemical, with satiety. And they appeared to reduce their normal intake. In other words, their normal calorie intake. So it appeared that olive oil actually affected them. When it was put, the regular olive oil into the yogurt affected them. And lard did not, and canola oil. Okay. Those people actually ate more calories.
Yeah.
So then they went to the second part of the study, which was the aroma.
Okay.
So instead of adding the olive oil, they took out the scent of olive oil and added the scent, the aroma to the extract. Half had regular yogurt, half just had olive oil scent added to the yogurt. No oil at all, just scent. And what they found was that, on the whole, if the scent was in there, it actually improved glucose tolerance. In other words, it actually changed the amount of sugar that was in their body. They didn't have the same abrupt swings, and they appeared to also reduce their calories.
Go away,
in other words,
really?
Had more satiation. So it may be the scent of olive oil that really makes a difference. It may not just be the oil. It may be the aroma, the scent that is actually making a difference to it.
I didn't know you could have the scent of olive oil without having the olive oil. How
well,
do they do that?
They were able to do it. They obviously put in some. I don't know how they manufactured and captured it. But, you know, we have scents in our room. We don't have chemicals. Some people put scents in their rooms, and they're, you know, actually they have a way of doing that.
I know taste and scent are closely related, but this is kind of amazing.
Well, it's kind of interesting because it's not just the way you digest the olive oil in your body and you swallow it. It's actually the scent that you have it. And when you think about it, you know, you buy a rose, you smell a rose, it has a certain scent. Does it make you feel good when you smell roses?
Sure.
Absolutely. It makes me feel good. Flowers make us feel good. And it may be that olive oil actually makes us feel good, but more importantly, more satisfied, so we may not be eating as many calories. So once again, this is sort of the scientific evidence of why olive oil may be the crown jewel of oils. And remind you again, extra virgin olive oil, extra virgin olive oil, extra virgin olive oil.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And now, Zorba, back to the phones we go. A listener joins in now from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hello. Hello, Dr. Zorba.
What's up?
Well, there's something I'm curious about. Generally, I visit my various doctors in the morning, and my temperature is, you know, they always do all your vitals, and my temperature will be 97.4, 97.8. Last time it was 97.0. Well, nobody's ever said that it was anything to think about or worry about, but I've just kind of wondered, is that why I'm a slow starter in the morning? Is that, is it medications? Is it genetic? What's it all about? And more importantly, if I really am sick, if I have a cold or a flu, and my temperature's, say, 99.9, am I sicker than, say, somebody who runs at 98.6?
By the way, that is a great question. And there are a couple of things that enter into there. There are genetics and a few things. But when you go to your doctor's office, how do they measure your temperature?
They do one of those. Sometimes they do that finger.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Clamp.
Uh-huh. Do they put something in your mouth or something in your ear?
No. They put a little clamp thing on your finger.
Okay.
Sometimes they run a.
Okay. But it's not.
One in your ear.
They don't put anything in your mouth and anything in your ear. Okay.
No.
Number one is the accuracy of measurements. Unless you have a thermometer and they put it in your mouth, it doesn't count. In other words, it doesn't count. It varies. Or if they do a tympanometer, if they do it correctly in the ear, and correctly means it has to have a good seal in the ear, that's also a good measurement. We no longer do rectal temperatures. So
Thank God.
I wonder why.
Thanks, God. Yeah, right. Tom wonders why. That has gone out. That's what they used to do when I was a kid. I still have a memory of it, and I have no idea how old I was, but I still have a memory of that thermometer. But we no longer do this. So you have to look at the accuracy of measurement. If they're doing a superficial measurement on the skin, it's open to lots of variation. So that's number one. Number two is not everyone is 98.6. It's a bell-shaped curve. Many people are 98.6. Some are a little bit lower. Some are a little bit higher. So it doesn't say whether or not you're sick or well. It's what your normal temperature is for you. And and from the way they're measuring it, it's all over the place because that's sort of what it is. Now, if you're out in the sun in the middle of the day and it's hot in the summer, your temperature is going to be a little bit higher. Your core temperature might be 0.1, 0.2, 0.4 higher. If you're running a fever, it might be higher. After you eat, it might be higher. In the morning, it's probably going to be lower. One of the other things is as you get older, I'm a medical director of a nursing home, and when we would take temperature on some people who are older, sometimes they'd be like 96 on our thermometer. And basically, well, it's a sampling. Once again, for the most part, it's sampling. A lot of older people, when the nurses would take their temperature with a thermometer in their mouth, they weren't able to close their mouth properly. And as a result, the sampling was off. So I wouldn't be stuck on the temperature. What you want to do, if you want to know that it's worthwhile for you, is get yourself a cheap, inexpensive $10 digital thermometer at the drugstore. Put it under your tongue. Measure your temperature for a week, every single day in the morning. Average it out. That's your average temperature. And then if you feel like you're sick, you can take it with your thermometer in the same ritualized way, and then you'll know whether or not you really have an infection or something, an inflammation that's causing your temperature to rise.
Okay. Terrific. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thanks so much for the call.
And by the way, it's very interesting. That is a common question that people ask in the office because people wonder whether or not the temperature is predictive of illness. And the answer is just one of the clues that comes in that can help us.
Yeah, my wife has a very low core temperature. And when she is not feeling well, goes to the doc, it's hard for her to convince the doc that she really isn't feeling
well. Right, because she has a low core temperature.
The temperature
is normal. Yeah, that's exactly it. You got it.
Before a quick break now, Zorba, I've brought you a little message from another vigilant member of the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police.
Are we going to call them the Vigilante Grammar Police?
That works. Mark doesn't have a problem with your facts, but he does take issue with the way you refer to them. I'll let him explain. He writes, I love the show, but please, Dr. Zorba, correct your use of the word data. Data is plural. Datum is singular. Do not state the data shows because it should be the data show. Thanks.
You know something. You would think that English were my second language. Notice how I missaid that versus English was my second language. It's my first language, but the real problem is I'm from Chicago. I mean, I was born and bred in Chicago. And, you know, we talk differently in the Windy City. And that's the problem that's all along. I'll try, but sometimes datum is sort of like, if I said the datum show or the datum shows, whichever way it is.
Shows.
I think people would say, what's datum? Is that a dog?
Okay. Well, now, here's something interesting.
Okay.
Just the other day.
All right. I'm ready. I'm listening.
Front page headline, New York Times.
Okay. I'm ready.
Recent data shows that blah, blah, blah. I was outraged.
Outraged. That's it.
I was. I've always prided myself in using datum.
So
I went to my Kindle.
Yeah.
I looked it up. I'm not sure whether it's New Oxford or Webster's. D-A-T-A.
Yeah.
Plural and singular.
Yes.
Now.
Yes. I have been. finally exonerated from this problem.
Yeah, I was puzzled. I was going to write the Times.
I know. And if you wrote the Times, they would pay attention.
Things change.
I think there's a movie by then.
So anyway, never mind. You don't have to correct anything. Have a plurality of problems with Zorba? Let us know in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org, and that's singular.
And be sure that you get it right when you correct Zorba's grammar. We have some more calls coming up, of course, some interesting research, the medical myth buster. But first of all, our recipes coming up right here on Zorba Pasture and Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 1-800-462-7413. But now it's recipe time, Zorba, and this week we have a guest who I think you'll really like. Slow cookers are all the rage right now, and Michelle Ciccoloni specializes in making recipes all in her trusty slow cooker. And her latest cookbook is right up your alley, Zorba, The Mediterranean Slow Cooker. The name of the book, it includes recipes ranging from hearty meat-based entrees to decadent desserts. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. I know slow cookers are pretty popular right now. How did you get interested in cooking with one?
Well, a few years ago, I began to notice that my busy friends were all asking me if I had any suggestions for slow cookers. And they were looking to eat healthier and eat at home more. And the slow cooker was a perfect solution for their problem. So I began to investigate and discovered that it really, really is a great convenience and something that I enjoy using all the time.
Right. Oh, no, they're wonderful things. I inherited my dad's slow cooker, which he inherited from my mom. And basically, it's the same slow cooker. I think it's 25 years old.
They don't break.
They absolutely don't break. Now, they're just down there. I mean, I look at mine, and it's kind of girly looking with little flowery things. And I thought, I've got to trade this in, give it to somebody else, and get one that's silver and nice looking. But in the end, it works, so I never... Yeah. I'm never get rid of it. Now, before we go on the recipe, what is charmoula? Because this is going to be salmon with peppers. Tell me a little bit about what charmoula is. I've never heard that word.
Well, the recipes in this book have a Mediterranean theme, and because I find that there are wonderful spices and herbs and vegetables that do so well in the slow cooker from that region of the world. And this is a sauce. It's a salsa, really. It's a fresh green salsa, and you can use it on fish, you can use it on meat, or you can use it as a dip for vegetables or for bread. And it comes from North Africa, let's say Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. They all have versions of charmoula, and once you've made it, it's just a really handy thing to have in the house. You'll find lots of uses for it.
Wonderful. I love. I was looking through the recipes. They look good. I'm also looking through slow cookers and dessert. Doesn't necessarily seem to go together. So I was looking at the Tuberi Clafouti. How do you pronounce that word?
That is clafouti in French. Mm. And it's basically a pudding. It's just a steamed pudding that is very traditional in France. They make it either with prunes or with dark black sweet cherries. They're wonderful. And you can, it's very simple. You're basically making a pancake batter, and you pour it over the fruit. And then it cooks beautifully in the slow cooker. And so you have this wonderful, warm, homey dessert, French style.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Well, now, there are a lot of recipes in the book, Zorba. Are we going to do the salmon recipe?
Okay. Salmon with peppers and charmoula, and I'm pronouncing it correctly. Okay, we'll go through this together. So you start out with a medium onion. Any particular onion or just a regular yellow onion?
A yellow onion is fine, but if you've got a red one or if you like a milder onion, go with red or a white onion.
Okay.
Great too.
One large red pepper cut into narrow strips. One large yellow pepper cut into narrow strips. So a red and a yellow, which, of course, makes beauty. And presentation, as my daughter Vanessa says, always counts in any dish.
Absolutely.
Always counts in any dish. Salt and pepper, which we're going to use. Half cup of water. Half cup of chopped fresh cilantro. So, if you know, I found that when I invite people over for dinner, some people like cilantro and some people don't. It's sort of an interesting herb in that people sometimes have a very strong opinion about that.
Yeah.
Do you find the same thing? I mean, they often...
I do indeed. And if you know you've got someone coming over who mm-hmm. doesn't appreciate that flavor, you could substitute parsley, nice fresh...
Okay.
Flat-leaf parsley would be perfect in this.
Okay, so flat-leaf parsley if they have it. One large garlic clove chopped, a teaspoon of fresh cumin, a half teaspoon of paprika, good paprika, right? I mean,
yes.
You use good paprika.
Yes, a flavorful kind.
That's right. There is a difference between the paprika that my mother used to put on her deviled eggs, which was the flavorless kind, and the good Hungarian paprika, which is the flavorful kind. A third cup of extra virgin olive oil, 2 to 3 tablespoonfuls of fresh lemon juice, and a salmon fillet, a thick fillet, about 2 pounds, cut into 6 serving pieces. Now, you do you use fresh fillets or frozen fillets? Does it make any difference in a case like this?
Well, if you're using frozen fish or frozen anything, mm-hmm. I advise people to thaw the product out, mm-hmm. whatever they're using, because it takes too long in a slow cooker for it to come up to a safe temperature. So if you have only access to only fresh frozen salmon, rather, then by all means use it, but thaw it properly in the refrigerator overnight so it doesn't lose too much of its juices.
Right. I think that is an excellent idea. And I use in a lot of the recipes, I use fresh salmon when I can go and get it, but I always have frozen salmon.
What's the best salmon?
Well, the best salmon for my daughter, Didi, who lives in Seattle, she would say Copper River salmon. Mm-hmm. But in Seattle, Copper River salmon is... $12 to $16 a pound.
I know it's expensive.
It's very expensive salmon, but I often use, I use whatever I get at the fish market. When I'm using fresh salmon, that's what I do.
How about you, Michelle?
I think that what Dr. Zorba is saying is correct. I look for the freshest salmon because on the East Coast we don't always get those wonderful West Coast salmon that you have. So whatever looks freshest and is in my budget, that's what I.
And in your budget, and that's where frozen salmon. That's where frozen salmon definitely comes in. So let's make the recipe. So scatter the onion and bell peppers in a large slow cooker, and sprinkle with salt and pepper. Add the water, cover, and cook on high for 1 hour. Then, in a food processor, combine the cilantro, garlic, cumin, paprika, and salt to taste. Process until finely chopped. Then add the oil and lemon juice, and taste for the seasoning. Then place the salmon in the slow cooker, spread half the sauce over the fish, cover and cook on low for 45 minutes or an hour, or until the salmon is cooked to taste. And to test for doneness, small cut in the thickest part of the fish. It should be slightly translucent. Then remove the salmon with a slotted spoon and serve with the remaining sauce. It sounds delicious.
It is delicious.
Absolutely.
It's very, very flavorful. And you've got all those beautiful colors, as you mentioned earlier. So you've got the colors from the peppers and the gorgeous salmon color and the green sauce on top. It's a great dinner.
I think you are absolutely correct. Thank you so much, and a great cookbook. I love it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.
To get a copy of today's recipe or to find out more about Michelle Ciccoloni and her cookbook, The Mediterranean Slow Cooker, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook and you can even like us if you'd like.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
What's up?
I'm calling about multivitamins. My stomach seems to be fairly sensitive to regular multivitamins. Even when I take them with food, about a half an hour after taking them, oftentimes I'll get fairly bad stomach ache, sort of nausea that goes along with it. It only lasts about half an hour and then it kind of subsides, but discomforting nonetheless. So I did some research online and found that iron-free multivitamins are much better for your stomach and as far as being sensitive in that way goes. But there still is a little bit of nausea associated with taking an iron-free multivitamin.
Sure.
So I've recently come across these sort of whole food multivitamins that advertise that the vitamins are derived from food so that they wouldn't cause stomach discomfort. I have not tried these multivitamins mainly because they are quite a bit more pricey than regular iron-free multivitamins. So I'm wondering what you're taking them and whether it'd be worth giving them a try.
Of course they're pricier. Number one, they're at Whole Foods, right?
Yeah.
You know, which is nicknamed Whole Paycheck. So anything at Whole Foods, by definition, costs more money because it's Whole Foods. Now, I'm not totally right. Obviously, their generics are actually quite good. But as soon as you advertise this is better, you're going to have to pay for the advertisement. You do that with the vitamins. So let's talk a little bit about multivitamins. First of all, women who are actively menstruating should be on a multivitamin with iron because you lose blood through menstruation and you want to replace it with iron. Guys do not need iron. Iron deficiency anemia in this country is an uncommon thing if you eat a variety of foods. Now, there are exceptions. People who are very, very strict vegetarians and vegans who don't have a balanced diet sometimes have iron deficiency anemia. But even for a good vegetarian or vegan, it doesn't occur. In other words, you get iron through a variety of sources. And the problem with taking a multivitamin with iron is not just that it can upset the stomach, but especially for older adults, is it can cover up an anemia that's developing from polyps or cancer in the GI tract that is actually going on. So we never recommend a multivitamin with iron, except, as I said, for menstruating women who then become anemic. So multivitamin without iron, number one, that works out well. Now, you still have some stomach distress. You know, whether or not it's derived from one or the other, the distress may just be there. So there are a couple of tricks to do. Number one, take it at bedtime. Quite often, people take it at bedtime. They don't get distressed. That's another thing. The next thing is, if that doesn't work, you can take a smaller vitamin. So I recommend the Gummy Bears multivitamins. Now, they're delicious. You chew them, and they're basically half a vitamin. Tom is laughing.
Just don't let a friend see you.
That's right. These Gummy Bear multivitamins. I'm taking it at bedtime with my little teddy bear pillow that I go to sleep with. Not exactly a turn-on, but nonetheless, a gummy bear-type vitamin, they're often vitamins that actually have less vitamin in them. And sometimes dividing that up into twice a day can make a difference too. Let's go back to another thing. How's your diet?
I would say pretty good. I mean, I don't always take a multivitamin. I guess I take it sort of inconsistently just because there are times when I don't want to have to deal with the discomfort of it. So, I try to eat as well-balanced as possible just to sort of make up for not taking a multivitamin with actually good food.
Yeah. I think eating actually good food is actually good. So have you taken the multivitamin at nighttime?
I have not. I try to take it with the largest meal of the day just because I feel that taking it with food,
it's a very reasonable thing to do, to take it with food. But if you're still having discomfort, I would try it at bedtime because it may be a mild discomfort and you won't notice it when you're sleeping. And if not, it's gummy bears for you.
All right.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And before we take a short break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take a quick question from Diane in Park City, Utah. I think Diane might be trying to drink away the pain, but I'll let her explain. She writes, "Hi, Zorba. I have horribly dry skin, but I hate using lotion. Can I drink anything to get rid of the dry skin, or do I always have to use something topical?"
Well, we do hydrate our skin internally. You know, we become prunes if we're dehydrated. But if we're hydrated enough so our urine is basically tea-colored, it's not going to do any good to drink more water. It's not going to make a difference. So looking from the topical point of view, the first thing you look at is how much are you removing oil from your skin? And we in America remove oil from our skin every day when we shower.
Yeah. Yeah.
In Europe, they don't shower very much. In France, they shower when they're dirty or once a week. And Europeans and Americans...
We're going to hear from so many people. Every time you say that, we're going to hear from so many people denigrating France. That isn't even true.
Europeans shower less than we do. That is true. They
don't
shower.
I want to see the science on that.
That is the truth.
That may be
1919
science.
The Germans shower less. It is not 1919 science. Getting back to the question. Our box will be full. Shower once a week or twice a week or three times a week. That'll make a difference. And what happens is you're removing the oil. And if somebody has some good information on how often the Europeans actually shower, you'd think they could possibly send it to us on our website. That's ZorbaPastor.org. That's the website, but it's Zorba@WPR.org. Send those emails about European showerings coming. Come on, bring them on.
We have some interesting research to talk about. Nothing to do with European showering, but interesting nonetheless. More of your calls. And, of course, our medical myth buster. Lots of great reasons for you to stick with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, sucking your child's pacifier clean may have health benefits?
Well, there are a number of issues here. First of all, we have become a germophobic society. You know, we have portable cleansers, we're cleaning our hands all the time, and we're always worried about germs. And there's good reason sometimes to be worried about germs. And parents have been worried about germs also. And there's a theory that the increase in asthma, allergies, eczema, and autoimmune diseases is that our bodies were made to fight germs from the very beginning. And when we raise a child in a totally germ-free environment, as germ-free as we can make it, they actually have an increased risk of developing some of these problems.
Interesting. Well, what about the pacifier?
Well, so the pacifier, so they look, this particular study published in Pediatrics, a very prestigious journal, looked at nearly about 200 children born in Sweden. And they looked at them when they were born, at 4 months, 16 months, during various months, up to 3 years of age. And they queried parents on the pacifier use. When the pacifier, for instance, got dirty, did they clean it off themselves by sucking on the pacifier? That's a common thing. I had four kids. Pacifier drops on the ground. You often don't put it in the patient's mouth, you know, in the kid's mouth.
Yeah.
You often suck it out yourself. Versus other parents who would say, well, that's a dirty pacifier. You're not going to use it. And then they go and wash it in the sink. They found that parents who sucked on the pacifier, okay, my mouth has germs in it, were more likely to have children who did not suffer from eczema, which is basically what we think of as a hyperallergenic type disease. They also found, in addition that we know of, that parents who delivered a child by C-section were more likely to get eczema than a child that came through the vaginal canal that is filled with germs. So getting back to the pacifier issue, it turns out that is a delivery system sometimes for parental germs. if they suck on the pacifier and then put it in the kid's mouth. And it shows that those germs may actually be useful for the child because the child's antibodies are not revving up and then producing an autoimmune response such as eczema.
So it's better for the child to have germs?
Correct. In other words, when a child that has germs in its mouth is then going to make antibodies to the germs versus antibodies to itself.
Well, what about if you just pick it up and give it to the kid?
Well, that's another way.
There are germs on it.
That's another way. But these are, but they were looking at parents who actually did that and wanted to clean it off and use their own saliva. Oh, no, that's another way. And we know that children that are born in environments who are allowed to play with dirt are less likely to have eczema and allergies and so on. And I think the bottom line of this study is sometimes we are too germophobic with our children growing up. And this idea of the pacifier, that you can clean your pacifier in your mouth and then give it to your child, may actually be worthwhile for the child and reduce the risk of eczema.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener, joins in now in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. We appreciate it. What's up?
Well, I've had back problems for years, and so has my wife. And I used to go to a chiropractor, but it didn't really help. And I was leery of some of the science behind it. Some of the, diagnostic methods and stuff didn't seem to, ring true to me, I guess. And my wife still goes, but, sometimes it helps her, sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it makes it worse. So my question is chiropractic actually, evidence-based science, and is that as effective as, physical therapy or other things?
Great question. So first of all, is there science behind chiropractic? Well, I think the science behind chiropractic is about as slim as you can possibly get. But saying that, does chiropractic work? And the answer is it does work for some people. There's no doubt about it. And studies have shown that. In fact, satisfaction studies show if you look at people who go in for back pain, orthopedic surgeons, primary care doctors, family practitioners, internists, we'll say nurse practitioners, chiropractors, they look at it and they say, who are you most satisfied with? It's often chiropractors. And believe it or not, it's not necessarily the manipulation, but it's that quote, they told me what was wrong. So chiropractors have their own belief system. They developed the same time that allopathic, my medicine, developed, and they developed a system that all problems arose from the spine. And for the most part, the idea that tuberculosis and other diseases and cancer arise from the spine has pretty much been, taken. I mean, good chiropractors no longer believe that. Yeah. However, chronic pain is chronic pain. So my recommendation for chiropractic is you try it out and you see if it works. There's no doubt. And in acute pain, it seems to be much better than a chronic pain. However, it works for a lot of people with chronic pain. Now, do we in regular, quote, allopathic type medicine have the answer to chronic pain? We don't. We don't. We have drugs. We have opioids. They have side effects, constipation, addiction, inebriation from opioids. We have anti-inflammatories. They're great, but they can cause kidney problems. We have Tylenol. It's wonderful, but it causes liver problems. So we don't have all the answers either. Now, is physical therapy better than chiropractic? I think there just are differences, different modalities. You try one versus another. So your wife goes to the chiropractor. How often does she go?
About once every other week or so. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that kind of annoys me, I guess, is sometimes she goes even if she's not having back problems because she believes that it's kind of maintenance.
Right. And there are a number of chiropractors that sell that as this is maintenance therapy. You nothing will happen to you if you do it. And once again, just because it's not evidence-based doesn't mean that it doesn't work for you. Evidence, science works for a number of things. How do you double-blind a chiropractic manipulation versus doing nothing? You can't. I think preventive chiropractic is on very, very shaky grounds. Very shaky grounds. I think that exercises, maintaining the right posture, training, using your body in an active way, I think that's on really good, solid foundation. But I think chiropractic really works for people with chronic pain, and you try it out and you see what it is. The other issue is money. you know, chiropractors will often say, well, come in 3 days a week for the next 10 weeks and, you know, we'll get you to 20 or 30 visits and your pain will go away. And there are lots of studies that show that the pain goes away in 10 weeks with and without chiropractic. And so there's no evidence that it actually cures it, but there is some evidence that it helps with some people with pain. So.
Yeah, and actually that was kind of my thought. It's sort of a, you know, post-hoc logic. I got better after I went, therefore it must have been because of that.
Yeah, and
sometimes I wonder if she had just, you know, just kind of walked around and stuff and stretched, she might feel better as well.
Correct. But if we look at it from a family point of view, some of this is where we put our discretionary money. And if your wife wants to put her discretionary money towards chiropractic, I don't think you're going to make much of a difference there in the family discussion.
You're right. That's pretty much what I told her. I told her if it works for you, go ahead and do it.
There you go.
Absolutely. This is one of those things where the guy can only be blamed.
Right.
Thanks for your call.
All right, thanks.
Yep, bye-bye. And Zorba time now for our medical myth buster. This week we're dealing with a negative that might be positive. Many of us have heard about the notion of negative calories, but do they really exist? Could eating a certain food really cause the body to burn more calories?
There is no such thing as negative calories. I mean that's not the case. In other words, the idea is if you chew lettuce, enough lettuce, you're going to burn calories because your jaw is just, there's so much going on with chewing in the jaw, and then the body takes so much energy to actually do that. And the answer is no. There's no such thing. If that were the case, we would just be eating stalks and stalks and stalks of celery, and America would just be losing weight. You'd see celery stores all over the place, and people would be walking down the street losing weight by chewing on celery. It just doesn't make a difference. There's some calories, you know, foods that you eat, which basically aren't going to put any weight on you, like celery, but please, you don't lose weight from doing. It is a gimmick.
Has someone posited a theory you need to negate? Send your myths along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And a Central Park, Montana listener with us now. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I love to walk, and the problem I have when I walk is if I walk too fast to get up my heart rate, my shins kill me, and then I have to stop walking for like a week or two before they're able to even be able to walk. And I've tried taking shorter steps because I've discovered when I walk with my husband, I try to match his stride, and then it really hurts. So I'm wondering if there's some exercises that I can do. I've tried the foot on the floor, tapping the foot, the toes at different aerobic classes, and that hurts in short order. And I'm just wondering if there's something, if I just need to do that more often, or what can I do?
Tapping the foot. Do you mean you've taken tap dancing?
No. I mean you hold your heel down on the floor and you tap the front of your foot.
Although tap dancing is fun. You could hold your heel down. You know, maybe you and your husband could tap dance and then put it on YouTube and do that as a video for the family. That's not bad.
I don't think so.
I'll tell you what. Zorba will tap dance and put it on YouTube. Won't you, Zorba?
I used to shuffle off to Buffalo. I could tap with, well, I was going to say I could tap with the best of them, but actually I could tap with the worst of them. It wasn't that I could tap with the best of them.
You could. You're not saying you will, though.
I am not saying that I will, but if I do, it'll be up on the website.
Okay.
I do have tap shoes at home in my closet. I might just
do it.
There is no, I am not. I am not promising I'll do it. We'll see what it is. There's not an embarrassment issue. I just don't know whether or not I could do it and keep from falling and killing myself. But back to the question.
Yeah.
Back to the question. So first of all, keeping up with your husband. That's a common problem, by the way, when husbands and wives, or not just husbands and wives, when partners walk together, one partner often walks quicker than the other partner. So that's an issue because somebody's walking quicker and the other one's walking slower. Finding a pace can be what that is. There are a couple of things. First of all, there may be a variety of different things that are going on in your foot, in your ankle, in your lower leg. And you really need to have an evaluation to see what are you doing wrong. It might be your gait. It might be that you aren't doing the right stretching exercises before. It might be the shoes that you're wearing. There's so many things that go on that can interfere with exercise. So one way to do it is to go to a physical therapist, call up your doc and say, hey, I need a gait analysis. Gait, G-A-I-T. Okay. I need a gait analysis. I've got some problems walking. I want a physical therapist who knows what they're doing to look at it. Now, when I say who knows what they're doing, I mean you want to call up, if you get a referral from your doc, and call up physical therapy and say, hey, who's a runner? Who's a jogger here? Who looks at shoes? Who can do this gait analysis? Because PT, for the most part, works on people after strokes, after injuries, after they've been in a cast and so on, and you want to have somebody who's trained in this. Alternatively, a good trainer can do the same thing. A kinesiologist who's been trained, maybe they have a bachelor's in kinesiology and they know what they're doing, they can do the same thing. Alternatively, a running store, there are people in running stores who fit you with shoes and they are dynamite in knowing what you can do in terms of stretching exercises to make a difference.
Okay.
And it's worth the money if you have to pay for it, by the way.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Yep. Because it hurts.
Good luck. So your husband wants to continue to walk with you?
Usually.
Usually. There we go. And yeah, that's another phone call.
That's right. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks. Thank you. And before we head out, Zorba, let's take a listener tip from an intellectual individual at Montana State University. DJ is a graduate student studying experimental psychology and has a theory for a phenomenon we recently discussed on the show. He writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I may have an answer to the mystery of why songs get stuck in our head. One potential explanation is the concept of thought suppression. This is a psychological phenomenon that occurs when we suppress an unwanted thought. The irony of this is that there is often a rebound effect, which actually means that the thought becomes even more frequent. Thanks for the great program."
Great idea. I think that could indeed be the case. You know, when you try to stop thinking about something, you keep on thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it to stop thinking about it. So that's very interesting. I find when I can't get a song out of my head, for the most part, it's because I played it too often. So it just goes on automatic inside my head.
Yeah.
But good idea. Maybe that's it. I think the jury is out.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the fact that DJ was sending us an email.
Absolutely.
About songs.
I love it. I love it.
Have a thought you can't suppress? Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
Or you can call us anytime, day or night, 800-462-7411. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show is produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leon Van Sidrum. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping that you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0601Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.